Ave and welcome to Emperors of Rome, the only podcast about the rulers of the ancient Roman Empire where you can hear a Latin greeting in a broad Australian accent. I'm your host Matt Smith, and with me as always is Dr. Rhiannon Evans, a lecturer in ancient Mediterranean studies at La Trobe University. This is episode XXVII, Ovid. Before we delve into the civil wars of Rome and the Flavian emperors, we turn over this episode to examine the life and work of the Roman poet Ovid. During his life, his work mightn't have been appreciated by the right people, but in later years it's come to be admired, in particular by his biggest fan, Rhiannon Evans.
Ovid was born in 43 BCE, which is the year after Julius Caesar's murdered, which is something I always like to think about because, of course, that is the beginning of the end of the Republic. That leads to the rise of Octavian, who's going to be Augustus, who's going to be the first emperor. And really, Ovid is growing up through all of that, through the, well, he's not going to remember the civil war with Caesar's assassins. He's 1 year old when that happens. But he will remember the civil war between Octavian and Mark Antony, which ends in 31. So Ovid's 12. But really, throughout his teenage years and his adult life, there is an emperor. There's the beginning of an empire. The principate is coming into being. So he's sort of growing up through the development of that system, which is an interesting time to be alive. He's also, though, not really been at the center of a civil war as such, certainly not the civil wars of Caesar and the assassins. And he's the generation after the great Roman poet Virgil, who did experience all of that. Virgil probably lost his land as part of the civil wars. Ovid seems to have been sort of insulated from that. And I think that leads him in a way, or it helps with the fact that he is a much more playful poet. He hasn't had to live through the deprivations of civil war.
So what do we know about his family and where he was born?
He was born in a place called Solmo, which is now Sulmona, in central Italy. So it's not very close to Rome, but not that far away. He was born to a wealthy family. He never seems to have had to earn money himself. He had what, I know we keep saying the traditional education of a Roman male, but basically anyone who has the leisure to become famous has the traditional education of a Roman male. But we know he did because he talks about it in his poetry. We know that he was trained to be an orator, with the hopes that he would become a politician, perhaps.
Like his father?
Yeah, his father, though, I've said he comes from a wealthy family, but he doesn't come from a family that's had political power. They're not famous. They're not a family who have been deeply involved in politics at Rome.
But they were rhetorics, so the hope is always that your children are going to be able to become politicians of some sort in that era.
It's pretty clear that Ovid had a great capacity with words from the beginning. So we can see that his family might well have hoped that he would go into oratory and that could potentially make his name through the political system, as, for example, Cicero had. That's probably what they hoped of for him. They sent him to Rome to complete his education. But Ovid tells us in his own poetry, a lot of which is quite autobiographical, especially his later poetry, that he disappointed his family. He didn't do what they wanted him to. His brother died, and that's kind of one hope for political greatness gone. And Ovid himself chose to give up oratory and become a poet.
He chose to give it up at that point, which I imagine was quite a disappointment to the family, for one son to die and for the other one to give up the family trade, so it is, or the family aspirations, and become a poet. It's rejecting a career to become an artist, which even these days can disappoint parents. I imagine that the death of his brother must have affected him quite deeply at that point, if he's turning away from the career.
I guess we can take that
it's
implication.
An inference.
Yeah, it's probably the case. Ovid's still very young at this point. We know that he put out his first book of poetry, so obviously he would have been practicing as a poet before he decides to publish. But we know that he puts that out in about 25 BCE, which is when he's 18. So he's very young. His family's not disappointed for perhaps the reasons we might be worried about a child deciding to become an artist, which is generally, it's a very uncertain way of making money. Now, Ovid's family doesn't need money. they're fine, but I guess they want the prestige that comes from being a public figure. Now, Ovid gets to be a public figure in a way that they would not have been entirely happy about, unfortunately.
So what does it take to be a poet in ancient Rome?
Well, I mean, anyone can be a poet, but to be a successful poet, well, it might take patronage, which means you're probably very able, that somebody with money has noticed that you're someone worth supporting. So we're talking about personal patronage. There's no kind of state patronage. There's no grants available for up-and-coming promising artists. And we know that Virgil and other poets had patrons who were often significant political figures, which of course means that poetry was often inflected with politics for the Romans. In fact, I can't think of a single Roman poem that isn't political in some way, however tangential. Now, for Ovid, he doesn't need a patron. He's financially independent. So this also, I think, affects the kind of poetry that he can write, because he doesn't have to kowtow to anybody. He can be far more outspoken. But he's growing up at this interesting time when, according to all accounts, especially people like Tacitus, writing much later, you really do have to be careful about what you say. Because this is a time when we're changing from republic to empire. Tacitus and a lot of writers who come later see the republic as a time when you could just say what you wanted. You could be outspoken. There was freedom of speech. But once power becomes concentrated in the hands of one man, once you have the imperial system, that's not true anymore. Because if the emperor doesn't like what you're saying, then you're in trouble in some way. So there's a strong implication in Roman writing that censorship really begins at this point.
Let's talk a bit now about the work he did as a poet in Rome. What kind of things was he writing about now? What sort of poetry do you think is the good Ovid stuff?
It's all good.
It's all good. Narrow it down a bit for us, Rhiannon.
We've got a lot of Ovid's poetry remaining. So as we know, we lose a lot of things from antiquity. We've only lost one thing that we know of by Ovid. It's a play he wrote, a Medea. We've got his earliest poetry, which he initially published in 5 books of poetry and then republished in 3, which suggests popularity if he's republishing it. And it's called the Amores, which means loves, and it's love poetry, which is a particular genre that's really popular at Rome at this time. It's written about often love as being very, very painful and difficult, and you get rejected by the girl a lot. And it's usually about heterosexual love. It doesn't have to be, but Ovid's pretty much all is. And he takes quite a flippant attitude to this. So previously there'd been poets like Propertius who'd written kind of very deeply emotional poetry, which still resonates today with us, about just how painful love can be. And it's, love is madness and it takes you over. Ovid's poetry starts with, he says he's going to write epic at the beginning of this poem, which is not what he does. He says, I'm going to write a poem about war. But then he makes a little joke. He says, Cupid comes along and steals a bit of his poetry and it's in the wrong format. He's not writing the right format for epic poetry anymore, so he has to write love poetry. And then he says, I better find someone to fall in love with then. So you can see that he's being very playful and very flippant right from the beginning. That's his very first poem. And he writes this initially 5 and then kind of whittles it down to 3 books of love poetry, which is brilliant. I mean, he's writing this at a very young age. It's comical, it's highly accomplished, and it must have made his name straight away as one of the prime Roman poets. And he publishes it, 6 years before Virgil dies? He's obviously setting up to be one of the main Roman poets after Virgil.
So as a result of this, what sort of life is he living? He'd become a celebrity in Rome at this point.
Presumably so. He would have been giving public recitations of his poetry. He's living at Rome. We know he got married. He got married 3 times in total. And eventually he has a daughter with his second wife. So he would have been living a very urbane existence. He's devoted his life to poetry now. So, you know, he'd have had all the leisure he needed for that. He has no public career, no ambition for that. So he doesn't really have to worry about keeping people sweet, either the people in power or the people themselves who might vote for him.
So do we know any direct reactions to his early poetry?
Well, We know one direct reaction, and that's from the emperor himself, who wasn't happy with Ovid's poetry and probably was most unhappy with a poem called The Art of Love. It sounds like a sex manual. It's not quite that exciting. It's a three-book poem, which is basically about how you pick up a lover. The first two books are directed at a man, how he can pick up a woman. And then he says in book three that there's been great demand that he should give advice to women. So book three is for a woman, how she picks up a man, which is mostly with makeup and making herself look beautiful. It's a very playful poem. It sets itself in a particular genre, which is didactic poetry. Didactic poetry is meant to teach you something. All right. So a typical didactic poem is a poem on farming, teaches you how to be a farmer, at least on the face of it. This didactic poem teaches you how to be a lover, or at least how to get a lover. It's almost like a deliberate stab at the establishment and Augustus, because I'm pretty sure back in the Augustus podcasts, we covered the fact that Augustus had brought in a series of moral laws. He'd brought in marriage legislation, for example. All right, so the first marriage law was in 18 BCE. Ovid's a young man at that point. And, you know, a decade and a half later, he's publishing a work about how to pick up a woman. The marriage legislation is aimed at encouraging legitimate marriage and legitimate children. He's talking about just getting hold of some woman at the games. Or most outrageously, he's got this whole passage where he talks about how you might be in the crowd at a triumph. And remember, by this point, it's pretty much only members of the imperial family that are getting triumphs. So you're in the crowd and you see a woman you like the look of and you think, well, how do I get chatting to her? Well, she's a woman, so she's probably going to say, who are those people there in the triumph? And you look at them and they're sort of shaggy barbarians and you don't know, but you say, oh, they're Gauls, and tell her all about them. You can just make it up. Just impress her. It's the kind of advice you might still see in a pickup manual, you know. Sound authoritative. Sound like you know stuff. It doesn't matter. She's not going to know anyway.
Did Ovid go into negging it all or doing magic tricks?
It's an early form of the game, basically, yeah. Yes. Of course, the worst thing about this is, well, it's bad enough that he's talking about this pickup line in a very flippant way. He's not talking about legitimate marriage. But it's worse to talk about doing that at this very formal, serious occasion that's meant to celebrate the grandeur and the might of Rome and also the imperial family. All right, so it's really this disjunction between what should be solemn, what should be grand, and talking about something that is extremely flippant and also just anti-establishment in lots of ways. It's almost like he's seeing how far he can go. And how far he could go was to really annoy Augustus to the extent that Augustus decided to get rid of him.
So how far he could go was Romania, essentially.
Yes. Now, The Art of Love, according to what Ovid says in his later poetry, seems to have been the spur for this. But it's a little bit difficult in terms of chronology because he published that in 2 BCE. And possibly it took Augustus 10 years to notice because Augustus exiles him in 8 CE, which is why some people think that it's not The Art of Love, but a different poem that caused him to be exiled. Now, Ovid was in exile in Romania on the shores of the Black Sea for around 10 years before he died there. He never got to come back, which is very sad. And he wrote 9 more books of poetry in exile. And these are the books of poetry, which are called the Tristia and the Letters from Pontus, the area he was, Pontus. He writes a lot of autobiographical detail in that. So that's how we know some of that early detail about his life.
What does it comprise of when somebody is put into exile then? It's not just being sent away. All your works are taken out of the library, for example, aren't they?
That's what happens to Ovid, yes, that he's basically censored. So his works are removed from the public libraries. And we know this from his exile poetry. By the way, nobody else talks about this. Only Ovid in his exile poetry talks about this exile. It's actually very touching. He talks about his poems as his children and that his children have been taken away and he misses them and all of this kind of thing. So we know they're removed from the public libraries, but obviously people kept copies. We've still got an enormous amount of Ovid's work, so it continued to be copied out, and luckily we've still got it now. But it is a form of censorship. It's an attempt to silence him. Ovid was lucky in a way because one of the things that could have happened was that he could have had his property taken away, which would have meant that his wife and his daughter would have been destitute in all likelihood. But they get to keep that. But of course, his wife can't come with him into exile, or she doesn't. He's separated from her forever, and he writes some very moving poetry back to her. But most of all, I think he misses Rome. He really misses Rome because we get the sense, well, I get the sense anyway, reading Ovid, of him being this very cosmopolitan figure who's really alive in Rome. And when he gets sent out to what is to him the Styx,
there's a big tonal change in his poetry.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. And he talks about it as being like death in some ways. And he talks about being the barbarian there because he can't speak the local tongue and they don't speak Latin or Greek, so he has to try and learn their language. And it's a much more basic lifestyle. It's actually a very nice holiday place now, apparently, on the shores of the Black Sea. But at the time, to Ovid, it would have seemed like just being sent to the outer perimeter of the empire, to nowhere.
So unlike other people who get sent into exile, he's never allowed back to Rome. So what do we know about his death? It's rather ambiguous when he actually died, isn't it?
We don't know exactly when he died because, as I say, he's the only person who refers to his exile. In fact, there is a creative theory that he invented his exile for publicity purposes. Because no one else talks about it. Other people refer to Ovid later on, to his poetry, but they don't mention his exile along with that. However, I don't believe that. If it was a fraud, it was a very consistent fraud because he wrote 9 books of poetry about it. The only way that we can fix his death is by what he mentions in his poetry. So we know he was still alive in 17 CE because he mentions an event from that year. That's the terminus postquem, we call it, the end after which, the point after which he must have died. So if you look in reference works, you usually see his dates as 43 BCE to 17 or 18 CE, because he doesn't talk about anything that happens after that, so he probably died around that time.
So since he's remembered as one of the greatest poets of the Roman Empire, it's clear that he's had quite an influential legacy. So what's your favourite work of the poet Ovid?
Well, anyone who reads Ovid, I think this probably is their favourite, and it's called The Metamorphoses, and it's his only epic poem. It's had an enormous amount of influence over Western poetry and Western art as well, because it describes mostly Greek, although some other mythological tales, and they all involve a transformation of some sort, hence Metamorphoses. So it gives us depictions of lots of Greek myths, some of which we've lost from any Greek sources. And it's been the inspiration for lots of Western artists, people like Titian. Titian painted an awful lot of Ovidian myth. There's a great one in the National Gallery in London of the myth of Actaeon. This is typical of the Metamorphoses. He's a mythical hunter who's out one day and he accidentally sees the goddess Diana bathing. And because he's seen her naked, she punishes him by turning him into a stag, and then his own hounds attack and kill him. There's a lot of punishment from gods to poor mortals like that. And in fact, that story is very significant because Ovid talks in that section of the Metamorphoses about Actaeon committing a mistake. He uses the word error, mistake. And he ends up in exile using the same word about his own mistake, whatever he did that got him exiled.
Yeah.
And he actually says that it was a poem and a mistake. Carmen et error, a poem and a mistake. We have no idea what that mistake is, none at all. But if it was similar to what Actaeon did, then it was an accident, or at least he's saying it's not my fault in some way. As innocent as Actaeon is in that poem, he's saying.
I walked in on somebody important.
Well, some people think it's that. They think it's something to do with something he saw relating to Augustus's granddaughter. Maybe he knew about her adultery. She ended up getting exiled too for adultery. Whatever the mistake was, we don't know. The Carmen, the poem, as I've mentioned, most people think is the art of love. And Ovid implies that himself in his exile poetry. But some people think it was the Metamorphoses because he was still revising that in exile. And so he could have included that word error there to point to this innocent mistake. And also, there are a lot of stories in the Metamorphoses that are about the abuse of power. So the gods have an enormous amount of power, and they often punish people in ways that are out of proportion, which is exactly the way that Ovid represents his own exile. He writes lots of poetry back to Augustus saying, I know that you think my poetry is a bit lascivious, but I didn't really do anything wrong. And, I'm sorry now anyway, and my behavior isn't reflected in this, so please let me come home.
And he never gets a reply from Augustus.
He never gets the reply. He never gets to come home. He actually lives into the reign of Tiberius, but Tiberius clearly isn't interested either. So he almost certainly died in exile, which I think is very sad for one of the, well, I think the greatest Roman poet, but certainly one of the most interesting and fluent poets of any age.
That's Dr. Rhiannon Evans, a lecturer in Ancient Mediterranean Studies at La Trobe University. And you've been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe to it in iTunes, and please tell your friends about it and leave us a review there. You can tell us about your favourite Ovid poem on Facebook, and you can follow both Rhiannon and myself on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans, and I'm at Nightlight Guy. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, we'll begin our look at the Civil War of 69 CE, and in the wake of the power vacuum that's left by the death of Nero, how four men would come forward with a claim to being emperor. Until then, I'm Matt Smith, you've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.